That fine journal, the Griffith Review, gives itself over to the millennials this month. There are articles and poetry and stories about all sorts of matters millennial, work technology, war, gender issues, and of course the future. But as we were flipping through the essays and stories, one caught our eye, entitled "Young Lady, That's Inappropriate, How the Legal System Works Against Women." Fine piece exploring several areas of the law where women seem to be done over by the law, both in their lack of representation as lawyers, in the courts, in the police force, and sadly, their overrepresentation as victims of sexual crime. Now, the article was written by Bree Lee, formerly a lawyer, but now a writer who is online to us tonight from Brisbane. You're a qualified lawyer, but you quit the law to write. Will you return to the law?
Hopefully not. Hopefully my writing can sustain me from now until the distant future. I think the only reason I would return to actually practicing law was if I really needed the job, or I suppose if I felt like I was putting on some kind of superhero cape and I thought that I could really make a difference by going into practice again. But that's sort of one of the reasons why I left.
Anyone who can do Peter Piper as brilliantly as that is a superhero in my book. Now, you started your legal career working for a district court judge. I presume you were full of zeal for your new career. How did it go?
Absolutely. For a fresh law graduate, getting a judge's associateship is sort of one of the top most exciting things that you could aim for and achieve. And they're normally always a 12 or 24 month contract. And I started and I was so excited. And as the year progressed, I just became more and more disillusioned with not so much just the legal industry, as in, you know, like the lawyers and the barristers and the judges, but more so the justice system, the real fundamentals and the foundations of our system, and became quite disgruntled with how I thought it was incredibly unfair towards women. And that's sort of why I'm sitting here now instead of just trucking along with that career path.
Your first bitter disappointment was the comparative rarity of women lawyers.
Absolutely. It's where do I even begin? I suppose we've got our first female Chief Justice of the High Court, which is incredible, but there have only been 5 women in total on the High Court since it was established 113 years ago, I think. In Queensland, only 7 of our 27 Supreme Court judges and only 9 of our 40-something district court judges are women.
But aren't more than 60% of law graduates women?
Absolutely. So my friends and I like to refer to that as the myth of the trickle-up effect, where, people sort of say, just give it time. But the statistics of how many young women are graduating from law school have been high for some time now, and we're just not seeing it trickle up sufficiently.
Did you take it up with your district court judge?
Oh, yes, I did. And for the record, I have utmost respect for him, and he was a real mentor for me. He was an incredibly generous man with his time, and he had a very strong social conscience as well. So if there could have been anything that could have kept me in the law, it would have been him. But at the end of the day, I just had to give this a crack.
Wouldn't you have become a judge in due course had you stuck around?
Maybe, I suppose, in several decades. But I just took a long, hard look at where I might be able to make change. And if I tried to make change from within the system, I would have had to toe the line for years and years and years before I was in any kind of position of power to be making a real difference.
Now, millennials are accused of being impatient to go places and then not sticking with things. How do you respond to that?
I don't think impatience is necessarily a bad thing. I think that impatience when it comes to issues of gender disparity can be a good thing. I would respond to that by saying that patience is what's got us to where we are now, where consistently more females graduate law school than males, and yet, you know, we don't see that reflected in positions of power. It's good to be impatient sometimes.
What becomes of the more than 60% of law graduates who were women and then hit the glass ceiling about 1 foot from the ground. What do they do?
Oh, well, that's an excellent question. I suppose I'm an example of some of us who just find other ways to use our talents and have them, you know, respected. We do know that, especially for the more commercial sort of normal lawyer route, that it only takes between 1 and 3 years for the gender pay gap to emerge. So it gets even worse, as you can imagine, when, you know, people are at an age where they start having children. So there's a lot of attrition.
I can't imagine someone like you settling down to working in a big law firm, doing something deadly dull or socially unworthy.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you.
But that's true, isn't it? You wouldn't have settled for a dull law job, even if you were generously remunerated.
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the other things that was a sort of nail in the coffin for a traditional legal career for me, was that I found that the normal trimmings just weren't fulfilling me. So I made a normal income, which it was my first job outside of university. So any full-time job would have felt like I was, you know, raking in the cash. But at the end of the day, it just really wasn't making me happy. And I thought, well, I'd rather be broke like I was at university for the next 10 to 15 years and doing something where I feel like I'm making a difference and doing something I believe in.
The wonderfully named Bree Lee is talking to me, and we are discussing the problems of women and the law. You looked into the Queensland Police, where the current commissioner wants 50% of recruits to be women. What's happened so far?
Yeah, well, the current commissioner, Ian Stewart, announced that directive last year, that 50-50 new recruits were to be male and female split. But the recent statistics are that in the top six sort of active ranks, it's only 8.8% female. Less than 10% of people in the police service are actually in power making decisions. And it's not outlandish to suggest that, a lack of females in high positions in any organisations has an effect on the cultural and priorities of those organisations. So, again, it's the same frustrating idea of the myth of the trickle-up effect, where it doesn't matter how many new recruits you get in, it doesn't matter how many fresh law graduates you have that are women, if you don't have institutions that respect them and are, you know, truly egalitarian in their approach, then they just won't stick around and you won't see real change.
We could spend the rest of our time together listing all the industries, all the professions in which a similar situation applies, where women are in fact relegated to lesser roles and lesser incomes. But let's stick around with your area of special interest. Why is it that only 1 in 5 women report a sexual assault?
Well, that's a very, as you can imagine, complex question. In terms of why more women don't report their assault, I would say that a myriad of factors that are both personal and institutional. On an institutional level, I would say that our current resources for women who have been sexually assaulted are woefully inadequate. We know that most case attrition, so that's, when a woman comes forward with a complaint and when that complaint is dropped, case attrition is highest at the police stage. So the Australian Institute of Criminology estimates that sort of less than 1 in 5 sexual offence incidents that are taken to the police actually result in charges being laid. So what we're seeing is that it is at an institutional level, even when a woman does come forward to make a complaint, for many different reasons, she is not heard. And the current system that we have to deal with those kinds of complaints is just inadequate. Another thing that we know is that, often women are still in contact with the person who assaulted them. So we know that, for example, the most at-risk demographic is young women, and they are most likely to be offended against in a domestic setting and without the use of a weapon. So what that tells us is that the young women are already in a position where they don't, you know, people they're almost always men. They don't need a knife or a gun to subdue them. They already are in a position where they feel dominated and controlled. And for a young woman to come forward and make a complaint against someone who is almost always known to her, of course, is a terrifying thing.
I used to, from time to time, go and sit at the back of the local court in the country town of Scone, and they had something called Ladies' Day, which is when local women came in to get AVOs, and it was an assembly line. And I was told that it was replicated in magistrates' courts across the state, across the country. And the other thing which intrigued me was that it was by no means class-based or limited, as one might have thought, to the lower classes. You know, there were middle-class women and even upper-class women who were coming in because they feared the violence of a bloke.
Absolutely. It's a common misconception which is connected to the way we like to think about the kinds of men who hit or sexually assault women. We like to think of them as other, as some kind of monsters or some kind of different from what we normally see and admire in a man. And part of that is that we do live in a classist society, and we make broad assumptions about people based on their socioeconomic levels, and that just fits into one of the myths that is so hard to shake about the kind of people who do this and the kind of people who suffer from events like this.
Bree, I learned from you that when criminal cases do get to court, in 70% of instances, the defendant pleads guilty, but in sexual assault cases, this goes down to only 30%. Can you explain this fascinating disparity?
Yeah, so that's it doesn't get more damning than that. What I put that down to is that we live in a society, and those people have gone through a system, the legal system, where the attitude is, why would you not see if you can get away with it? Because a fraction of women who are assaulted or raped ever even report the crimes done to them. When they do report them, a fraction of those ever even result in a man being charged for the offence. So by the time you get to a stage where a man has charges laid against him, he is such a tiny representative of people who have done those similar acts, because he lives in a society and he's travelling through an institution where the vast majority of people just like him, who've done horrific things just like him, have gotten away with it.
One wonders too whether male police, a male dominated police force, perhaps doesn't take it as seriously as it should.
Yeah, and that's in that essay, this essay that I've written for the Griffith Review, I've sort of tried to tie all of these separate facets of the issue together, because it's also an issue at the prosecution stage. So if a man is charged, and it gets passed on to the Department of Public Prosecutions, once it gets to that stage, that's where we see the second most likely point of attrition, when a case just gets dropped. And that's, it's at the prosecutor's discretion whether or not to go ahead with a trial. And we know that cases are significantly more likely to proceed where a complainant, so that's where a young woman normally, was injured, where she had, you know, really physically and loudly expressed non-consent. And also things like when the defendant, you know, when the man who's accused was non-Caucasian, which is, you know, incredibly awful. And just goes to show how these myths and how these ideas of what society and what people think a rape looks like just work exactly against the vast majority of experiences of young women who, like I mentioned just before, it almost always happens without any injury, because it happens without a weapon, and it happens in the domestic setting with people that they know.
And psychological brutality can be as profoundly damaging to a woman as overt physical abuse.
Yes, of course. Yep.
And I don't think people begin to understand that. I didn't realise that in Queensland, drunkenness is still seen as a mitigating factor for the perpetrator in cases of sexual assault.
Yeah, so what we talk about with that is that it is specific to Queensland still, where it is a defence to a to a charge of sexual assault or rape, that to say that you, it's called mistake of fact defense. And that's where if a man is under a honest and reasonable belief that the woman in the picture was consenting, that even if she wasn't, that they will be found not guilty. And there's a famous case, well, I should say infamous case, where a man in Queensland of his own enthusiasm and volition became incredibly intoxicated. And because he was so drunk, it was easier for him to prove that he mistakenly believed that the woman in question was consenting. And there are...
extrapolated into drugs?
Yes, because as long as it was... There's a separate question if an individual was under the influence of something that they hadn't voluntarily taken, but if it was drugs or alcohol, it's treated in a similar way.
Mm. How do you think the management of sexual assault cases could be better handled by the police and the legal system? And in asking that, of course, it's painfully obvious that if a much higher percentage of women came forward, the system would simply collapse under the weight.
Absolutely. So it's, I hate sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but when we know what tiny fraction of women ever come forward and what tiny fraction of those cases are ever, you know, proceed to charges being laid, the system would absolutely entirely collapse. And so when you have a police service that is potentially overworked and under-resourced, of course that's going to have an effect to how likely they are to take on extra caseloads every time a young woman fronts up with a complaint like this. But there are some incredible, there are lots and lots of really simple ways that we can do a lot better than what we're doing now. I hate the idea of talking about this and people putting it in the too hard basket.
Well, tell me about the system called You Have Options, which is up and running in Oregon.
Mm. So a woman called Carrie Hull from the USA has developed this program. It's called You Have Options. And in their first year of running it, they saw over 100% increase in the reporting of sexual violence. And the absolute most basic tenet of what it does is that it gives complainants control over their own matters. So when a person, normally a young woman, contacts the police, they get three options. They can lodge an information-only report, or they can request a partial, and they can request a full investigation. And so one of the things that we see quite often, one of the other barriers for young women trying to access justice and make a complaint, is a fear that they will be identified and a fear that the person who they're accusing will be informed of their complaint, because lots of women aren't in situations where they feel safely distant enough from the perpetrator of the crime. And so one of the things that this You Have Options program does is it gives a young woman an opportunity to go to the police and say, "This thing has happened to me. I would like, for example, for a rape kit to be done. I would like for you to take my statement now. I would like for you to, look at telephone records or find cab records and record all this information as you would a normal investigation, but I don't feel comfortable yet with the idea of pressing charges." A young woman could say to that police officer, "I might feel more comfortable pressing charges if somebody else comes forward ever in the future. It might just be a matter of time when they're building up confidence or finding a more safe living situation from which they can then feel like they can go and actually proceed and request that charges be laid." And what it means is that if those matters do eventually proceed to trial, there's no delay. One thing juries hate is the idea that a woman doesn't front to the police station as soon as she's assaulted. It makes juries for some reason find it very difficult to believe that a woman would not want to shout it from the rooftop that they have been raped. And so what this You Have Options program does so well is that a woman can turn up to the police station the day after in absolute feeling of safety, that no decisions about her case are going to be made without her. And even if she doesn't feel comfortable or safe enough to proceed that matter to the next stage, until 5 years down the track, if it does then go to trial, she is on the record as having made an immediate complaint about what's happened to her.
I think that concept of calibration and the process is quite extraordinary, apt and appropriate. Thanks for that. Incidentally, Should young women be considering entering the legal profession?
Yes, we need more of you. Don't quit like I did. Yes, honestly, yes. If one thing that I knew that would happen and has happened is that I got somewhat addicted to the sense of significance. And if you care about learning about the way our society works and the fabric of society, there's a career in the law is so incredibly fulfilling and satisfying. I would really love to see more women get in and stay in the legal industry. But having said that, it's in the hands of the current power holders to a certain extent, as most, you know, systems are. But there is a good deal of impatience in my peers, which I think is a good thing.
Good on you. Koala stamper Bree Lee, author of the article Young Lady That's Inappropriate in the millennial edition of the Griffith Review.